All units proceed to your post assignments. All units proceed to your post assignments.
Well, it's not really the lightning round today, but usually on Tuesdays, we have the lightning round in which Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less, but we are departing from that format today because we have Eva Bartlett joining us, a great freelance journalist who recently spoke with Scott on his other podcast, and she comes to us today from where, Eva?
Just outside of Moscow. I just came back from the DPR.
Whose car is that? Eva's or Scott's?
Not mine. Mine will chime in soon.
All right.
We'll yeah, So I'm just outside of Moscow. I just a few days ago returned from the Donetsk People's Republic.
Got it. So Scott was acknowledging the difference between you two the other day in that podcast. And, you know, he was saying that he has the luxury of sitting at a computer and, you know, has the access to the internet. He can be very comfortable sitting at his desk doing that. And you're on the ground in the heart of the action. And he was right to acknowledge that there's no substitute for that. But on the other hand, it seems to me you could use the sort of support that major media organizations have for their reporters, like something comparable to a newsroom, which I know doesn't do any good if it's a lousy newsroom. But do you compensate for that in any way? What's the way you operate, if at all, that can compensate for that? Do you have some sort of support system to help you?
Not really compensation. I mean, basically what I do is I get things out slowly because I do everything myself. I do ask friends for translation help, but I do the subtitling manually. I do the editing. I write whatever, if I want to add a voiceover, I obviously write that. I do the research. So I'm basically doing it on my own, which I prefer because I, you know, whatever. It's simple quality what I put out. It's not flashy by any means, but it is at least something I stand behind. I'm speaking in terms of videos. In terms of articles, of course, I write everything that I publish. There are sometimes, you know, editorial changes to titles or subtitles or whatever. If there's ever anything I disagree with, then I immediately say, you know, to whichever publication, like, please change this, and they do. So I guess the long answer is I don't know how to reply to the compromise, but I put out content that I stand behind. It would be super helpful to have a team of, you know, camera person, translator, editor, everything else, but I don't.
Yeah, well, maybe there's an opportunity for us to cooperate in the future, because I think that might be the future. That may be the next step that independent journalists can take, is to figure out some way to collaborate. Seems to me like a natural progression. So let's talk about a specific situation. Scott just released one of his 2-minute videos, and in it he was talking about how the Ukrainians are executing prisoners of war. And again, he's writing from upstate New York. You're on the ground. Can you tell us anything about what you know that might corroborate that, whether it's specifically executing prisoners of war or torturing them or anything along those lines?
Well, to be honest, I don't have any frontline personal experience with people who have, like, loved ones that have been tortured or executed. I did seek to interview Donbass or Russian soldiers that were exchanged in one of the prisoner exchanges with Ukrainian soldiers. I wasn't able to do so, but I did try. I did interview two Ukrainian soldiers that were captured. One was captured and one surrendered to Donbass Russian forces. And from their side, they said, I mean, of course, I know people will take this with a grain of salt. They will probably say, well, you know, they're in captivity. Of course, they're going to say this. But they said they were treated well. They said they were being given 3 meals a day. They said they weren't beaten or tortured. They said they were surprised by how well they were being treated. So I can speak from that perspective. And then I'm sure we're all following similar Telegram and other channels where we see the horrific reports of Russian and Donbass native Russian soldiers being tortured and executed. So that's basically what I can speak to. Maybe Scott can, well, I mean, you made the video, so of course you can chime in. But in my opinion, what it seems is that Russia maintains a standard of professionalism, not torturing prisoners of war. And it aligns with what I've heard when I've spoken with Russians, just normal Russian civilians and also Russian soldiers, on their views on Ukrainian people. And they differentiate between Ukrainian Nazis and Ukrainian people.
Yeah. So how about it, Scott? To what degree are you confident about the accuracy of that, what you said in the video, that they are executing prisoners of war?
Well, let me just start that I'm not sure that we're speaking with the real Eva Bartlett here. She had a dog up here, and I've seen videos of her dogs, and they've never been that well behaved. So I think we might have an imposter here, Jeff.
Is this one of those artificial intelligence videos?
I don't know. I'm beginning to get a little concerned. The Ukrainians, you know, have both Eva and I on their hit list, and you know, they may have replaced her with a hologram, because that dog is extraordinarily cute and well-behaved. But
intervene, but my dogs are always very cute, but it's after what? It's after 11 p.m., so they're in, like, sleep mode.
Ah, okay. Well, now we know the secret. We need Maverick to be in sleep mode. But, no, this is what I'll say as far as that. I mean, Jeff, you know, as you said, rightly so, I'm far distance removed from ground truth. So I'm a long distance sniper here when it comes to, you know, information and assessing. But sometimes the proof is in the pudding. The Nazis, and they are Nazis. Let's not pretend that the Azov battalion is and was anything else. These are brutal Ukrainian ultra-nationalists who have embraced wholeheartedly the odious ideology of Stepan Bandera and Adolf Hitler. It's on their tattoos, on their body, on the gestures they make, and on the way they behave, the way they have singled out ethnic Russians as subhumans and the treatment that they give. Now, let me just go into history. In my 2-minute video, I spoke of the Malmedy massacre, which, of course, in World War II, an SS Panzer group captured 120 American soldiers and executed them. Now, some of the soldiers escaped, but they executed them. They went in close, put the coup de grace with a bullet through the head on at least, I think, around 40 of them. And when American troops found the bodies a few days later, a general order was given by the regimental commander of the unit that found the bodies not to take any prisoners. If you find a Waffen SS, you capture a paratrooper, because some of the troopers there were from the 8th Parachute Regiment, I believe, kill them on sight. This is an American commander giving orders to American soldiers in direct violation of the laws of war, and nothing happened to them. Nothing. And I bring this up to say that, you know, in America, we like to pride ourselves with our adherence to the law of war. I do. I know that, you know, that's one of the things that I always felt separated me from other military, you know, around the world. I know it's not perfect. I know people are going to point fingers and say, well, you know, Abu Ghraib. And of course, it all happened. No one's denied it. But in principle, Americans are supposed to adhere to the laws of war. The Russians captured thousands of these Azov Nazis in Mariupol, in the city they literally pillaged, raped, plundered, tortured from 2014 until liberation in 2022. They captured thousands of these people with evidence of their crimes on their videos. I mean, there's something about these Nazis that make them want to record their crimes and brag about it. And there is evidence after evidence after evidence of these people having committed crimes. Now, had they been American soldiers, they probably would have lined these people up against the wall and just shot them on sight, because we have a history of doing that. But they didn't. They captured them. They treated them. They gave them medical care.
Yeah.
They put them in a prison. They fed them. They allowed them to communicate with their families. They complied with international humanitarian law when it comes to the treatment of prisoners of war. The most odious people on the planet, just about, got treated like humans, even when legally they didn't have to. For instance, some of the mercenaries that were captured, they don't qualify for prisoner of war status. They're illegal combatants. In theory, they could have been given a hasty tribunal and shot on sight. But no, they not only were treated, but they were exchanged. So you wanted the proof, Jeff? The proof is in the pudding. The Russians have behaved admirably in this regard. I'm not saying that there isn't an occasion. I know somebody's going to come out with the video that shows a Russian shooting a Ukrainian. But here's where the difference is. In Ukraine, they celebrate the men who execute the Russian prisoners. In Russia, I guarantee you with 100% certainty that if a Russian soldier was found guilty of executing a Ukrainian prisoner, he would be held fully accountable by the Russian military justice system, because the Russians are serious military professionals. They make mistakes just like every other serious military professional out there. But when it comes to how they treat civilians, how they treat the prisoners of war, their behavior is above reproach.
All right. Well, you seldom mention Nazis without using the word odious. And the reason I bring that up is because while we have Eva here, I think there's something you both have in common, which is you're both kind of hybrids. You're sort of a journalist slash advocate. In Eva's case, she just flat out identifies herself as a former activist who then segued into journalism. So I'd like to ask both of you, starting with Eva, what's your take on combining advocacy with journalism as it relates to you and in general? And do you think there's any such thing as unbiased reporting anyway? In other words, if somebody were to do it in the more straightforward, old-fashioned, conventional way, a la Walter Cronkite or whatever, is that even a thing, or is it impossible to report without some sort of bias?
No, I do think it's impossible unless you're a robot or you're strictly adhering to reading the scripts of, you know, whatever intelligence agency you've been given the script from. I think it's impossible to have some sort of bias. I mean, look, I've been going to the Donbass. Well, my first trip was in September 2019. And then since March this year, I've gone, I think, six times for about 3 weeks each time. I've seen the you know, bodies of Donbass civilians strewn throughout the streets. I've experienced the bombings at close proximity. So for me, it is very personal, not just because I've experienced the bombings at close proximity, but because I've smelled the blood of these people that, you know, I've gone there to try to talk to and try to learn about. I've seen how horribly upside down world distorted their realities have been purveyed in Western corporate media, just like as was in Syria. It's parallel misreporting on the realities of these people that, in fact, just like in Syria, their narratives are whitewashed from the media. They're erased from the media. They don't exist because they don't fit the narrative of the Western corporate media. So it's very hard to have experienced all that and to just be like, yeah, well, I'm unbiased and I'm neutral. I'm sitting on a fence. No, I'm not sitting on a fence. I'm very much on the side of the people that are fighting for their existence. And I think, I don't want to put words in the mouth of someone like John Pilger, but I'm fairly certain he, you know, John Pilger, one of the original esteemed journalists and documentary makers, award-winning journalists and documentary makers. I'm fairly certain, I mean, I've spoken with and I've certainly read and viewed his work, that he would say that that's what the original journalists did. They didn't take scripts from governments or from feeds. They went to the place in question and they would be affected by what they were seeing. How can you not be affected when you're seeing bodies being torn apart by your government? The other thing is, you know, these journalists that pretend to be all neutral, that are reporting from far, far afar, I should say, and they're literally reading the lines that they've been given. Why should their neutrality be more credible than somebody who's seen 16 bodies in one day blown apart and is a little bit emotional about that. I mean, we're human beings. Of course, smelling and seeing death, you're going to become emotional. So I don't believe in this this myth of a neutral journalist. If people want neutrality, or if that's what they perceive is important, then you won't find it in me, because I'm very much moved. This is my struggle too. I'm not from the Donbass, but I've heard the stories of the people there, and it's personal for me. So I don't know. I don't know what to say. Like, I can't be that neutral person.
Right.
On the other hand, if you look at the videos I put out, I don't put like dramatic music. Today, for the first time, I put a tiny bit of music to the video of a teen, a 14-year-old whose foot was blown off by a petal mine fired by Ukrainian forces in July. And these petal mines are still blowing people's limbs off now, months later. I put a tiny bit of tiny music, like very neutral music, to this clip. It was like a less than 2 minute clip. That's the only time I've done anything like that. The rest of the time, my reporting has been very matter of fact. And I've had people say, like, how can you be so calm? So I'm sorry, now I'm not being calm, but
that's what we want. So unlike Malcolm Nance, you've never put on a uniform and pretended that you're fighting on one of the sides. That you're familiar with Malcolm Nance, our mascot.
No, I mean, our mascot. I never wore flak. I never wore body armor until September 2019. So my time in Gaza, my time in Syria, I never had it. Reporting from Donbass, I've worn it. I wear it only in must-wear situations.
Wearing it for protection is one thing. He says he's like actually fighting in the war. Here, let's.
Yeah, let's
hear it in his. It's always fun.
I'm done talking. All right. It's time to take action here. So about a month ago, I joined the International Legion here in Ukraine, and I am here to help this country fight, you know, what essentially is a war extermination. This is an existential war.
He's right. It is a war of extermination of the Donbass people.
Murdering civilians. And there are people here like me who are here to do something about it.
So anybody who says that people like you are too biased, so just remember this guy is supposedly an MSNBC commentator. And at the same time, he says he's fighting the war on behalf of Ukraine.
Well, let me just add one quick thing. Back in 2017, I was giving a lecture about my reporting from Syria, and I was in Montreal, and two Canadian prostitutes came to my lecture, and I knew that they intended to smear me because they had already contacted me saying they wanted to interview me and they thought my work was interesting. A quick look at their Twitter feed let me know like where their allegiances were, and that was with Al-Qaeda in Syria. And they did their little smear piece on me. And one of the things they took issue with, well, they totally misconstrued my lecture. They totally omitted what I'd said about terrorist bombing of Aleppo in my four visits there in 2016 and how 10,000 civilians had been killed by that bombing. And they took issue with the fact that I wore a bracelet that had the Syrian flag. And they said, no journalist of any credibility would wear this. So I go to the Facebook page of the author of this piece, Agnes Gruda of La Presse, a Canadian publication linked to, I'm pretty sure it's linked to Radio Canada, so Canadian government. And I find very quickly jihadi Agnes in Libya holding a jihadi's gun. So, you know.
Gotta love it. Gotta love it.
Malcolm, right. Agnes.
All right. So before we get to the questions from our audience, Scott, do you want to say anything in response to my question about
I can't even imagine how you begin to smear somebody like Eva Bartlett. I mean, it's just beyond comprehension. Now that doesn't mean you can't take issue with reporting. Mm-hmm. Let's say Eva reports on something and I take issue with it. I don't think it's an insult to Eva for me to say, hey, Eva, you said X, but you know, YZ has also been up there. You know, how do we square that? That's legitimate intellectual discourse. And I have no problem people doing that with me. And I think Eva is very careful to reduce the potential for that. That's legitimate, but smearing someone like Eva, who's out there doing the job, I mean, that just, it shocks me that that's even something that people would want to do. But let me just say right up front, I'm not a journalist. I don't play one on TV. I didn't spend the night at a Holiday Inn Express, so I can't even fake it. I don't pretend to be a journalist. There's been occasion where I have been hired by journalistic outlets, but that's primarily to give my opinion. So already, you know, I'm not a journalist. I'm an opinion person. But my background is intelligence. And here's the interesting thing about intelligence. The further away you are from the problem, the less credibility you have. You know, this is why I want to debrief the force recon guy who went across the beach, went over the hill, gained access to the site, took the photographs, interviewed the people, et cetera, and came back. I want to talk to him. I don't want to talk to the intelligence analyst who monitored it over a drone footage thousands of miles away. People went, you know, what made me a success as an intelligence officer was that I was on the ground in the Soviet Union doing stuff. And they wanted to hear my perception, my observations, my analysis based on firsthand experience. And during the Iraq War, what I experienced personally is what had value, not what other people, you know, my interpretation, what other people did. And I try to apply that same approach to my analysis here. I mean, I'm no longer frontline Johnny. I don't play that game. God bless Eva and those who do. It's not what I do. As I said, I'm a long distance sniper, but I don't pretend not to have bias. My bias is fact. My bias is truth. I will line up the facts and then I'll do assessments using my training as an intelligence analyst. I believe that that's far more accurate than what passes for journalism today. As Eva said, you know, I'm the same school. I don't receive a phone call from sources. People keep coming and go, Scott, what's your source on that? This earlobe, right here, man. This brain, right here. As imperfect as it is, that's my source. It absorbs information, and then it muddles it around, and then I take these fingers, and I type on a keyboard, and stuff comes out. That's the process. I'm not somebody who has to call up somebody to get confirmation or to double check or anything of that nature. So I don't think it's fair. Eva is a legitimate journalist, even though she doesn't maybe like that term. Her journalistic style is integrity, as opposed to people who are stenographers for, you know, whatever their sources are. I don't pretend to be a journalist. I'm not one. I'm not trained to be one.
It depends how you define journalist. I mean, you know, maybe we shouldn't waste time quibbling over semantics, but it seems to me that just because you're operating in the realm of opinion doesn't mean it's not journalism. It's opinion journalism. Are you, in your mind, is journalism just when you're on the ground, so to speak? Is that the distinction? Why aren't you a journalist?
Because I don't want to be a journalist.
No, but what is it that you do that doesn't fit the definition is what I'm asking.
Well, first of all, I'm not here to report anything. Mm-hmm. I think a journalist reports. I'm not here to report anything. I write on what I want to write about. I focus on what I want to focus on. So I think a journalist is somebody, again, I can't speak for Eva because only she can. But I would imagine that when she goes to Donbass, she's getting the experience. And then from that experience, stories emerge. And then she follows the stories. I don't operate that way. I'm an intelligence officer. I focus in on a problem and I zoom in on it and I collect on that problem and I write on that problem. I'm not there for the experience. I'm there to answer a specific question or set of questions. So I think there's the difference.
Okay. If I can just jump in too, like that's absolutely right, Scott. Like I will go and think like, okay, I want to write on the issue of the water, you know, the water problem, because Ukraine is incessantly attacked Donbass's water infrastructure, and it's a real problem for people there. Or, you know, I have maybe have some particular issues I want to write about, like the petal mines. But if something happens, then I will go, you know, like the central market is bombed, then I will go there and maybe I'll put my flak on, or maybe not. And I will go there and I will see what I can report. But I know that that's not how Western corporate media or legacy media operates. They usually go to a place with a, they have a story in mind, and they disregard almost everything they see. And I say that, I can't remember, Scott, if we discussed this, I've seen it in Syria many times over, but with respect to Donbass, in March, I joined a Ministry of Defense delegation for 2 days in the Donbass. And basically what the two French mainstream media came out with, they disregarded everything we'd been told. And the only thing they reported was like, this is what Russia wants us to see. They showed a little bit of like the humanitarian aid being given out, but they didn't talk about the chief medical officer in Volnovakha saying Ukrainian forces had occupied the hospital and mined it, or any of the other horrific things we'd heard in the 2 days. So that's one example. I can give countless examples of how MSM operate in Syria. But yeah, like back to the point, like Vanessa Beely, who I'm sure you're all aware of, lives in Syria and has been reporting from there for a long time. And the way journalists like us do operate is, yeah, sometimes we have something we want to investigate, and other times we are just at a scene and something happens and we can go there and report on it without this cookie cutter kind of like, I'm going to take certain things and then like disregard almost everything that has happened in order to fit my Western mainstream narrative.
You said that you're just outside of Moscow now. Do you live there, or is that just where you're staying?
No, I moved here in January last year. I left Canada in February 2020, went to Syria for what I thought was going to be a couple of weeks. The border closed due to the, you know, issue of COVID. I spent 6 months there, actually living quite freely compared to how people were living in the West. And after that, went to Serbia and decided I wanted to move to Russia because Canada became just absolutely bonkers. But at this point, if I want to go back to Canada, now there's a couple of things I actually want to mention. I think I'm sorry, Scott, I don't remember if we touched on this, but like if I wanted to go back to Canada now at this point, it's I think pretty risky for me. I'm not afraid of risk or danger, but like I'm also not stupid and I don't want to, like I have a happy life here with my dogs and simple existence. So why go back to Canada if I risk being thrown in jail because I've reported from Donbass, or risk being assaulted by one of these extremists that Canada has given safe haven to and would obviously not protect me from? But the other thing is a journalist, an investigative journalist I know, just this morning I got a message from him saying, I'm trying to remember the term. Apparently, I'll find it if you want while you're talking later, I can try to find this thing. But I shared it on my channel, and basically, some of the key players related to the coup in Maidan, the Maidan coup, sorry, in Ukraine, and the current war, they're trying to basically list people like myself and people who've reported from Syria as enemy combatants. I don't know what would follow that if they succeeded in somehow listing us who report from places that the U.S. is targeting as enemy combatants. But I suspect that could set the stage for saying, okay, well, they set foot on U.S. or Canadian or whatever soil and they're arrested or all their assets are seized. Not that I have any assets, but, you know. So, yes, I am in the outskirts of Moscow and intend to stay here when I'm not in the Donbass.
Well, yeah, enemy combatant, you would be, you could be taken to Guantanamo.
But now, Scott, like what is an enemy combatant? Isn't it somebody who's held a gun and actually used it against somebody, which I've never done in my life?
They're trying to expand the, I mean, this is the ridiculousness of the situation we're in, where the State Department sits at a Center for Countering Disinformation gathering roundtable in Ukraine and allows them to define me, you, and others as information terrorists.
Yeah.
You do know the United States assassinated an American citizen in Yemen who never held a gun. He was a propagandist. And so he was classified as enemy combatant And because he was a propagandist for Al-Qaeda, he was killed. I think his young 16-year-old son was assassinated as well, by drones fired by American. We've gone insane. The United States, and with all due respect to Canada, Canada's just literally totally gone bonkers on this. Yeah. The concept of, you know, they put Julian Assange in jail and they're trying to extradite him to try him for things that if an American were done, is protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution. Journalists do what Julian Assange does, not as well, by the way, every day, and get Pulitzer Prizes and they win awards. This is the first time I heard it, but I'm shocked and I'm sickened and I'm upset that you would be considered an enemy combatant simply for reporting from the ground. What has this freedom-loving world, and I say that with as much, Jeff, help me out.
Sarcasm, I think, sarcasm, is the word.
Thank you, Jeff. Jeff is my walking, talking dictionary. But sarcasm is not even right. Sarcasm means that rancor. I mean, this isn't sarcasm. I mean it with rancor. I mean it with anger. My God, what have we become? If we're, you know, and I don't want to put Eva on a pedestal. I respect her work, but I don't want to sit here and have people think that I'm just bowing before the statue of Eva, the idol of Eva. No, she is doing a great job. But regardless of what you think of her work, I hold in high regard. But even if you don't, it's not a crime to report from a battle zone. Jeff, I'm sorry, I'm on one of my rants. You got to tolerate me. There's a colonel I used to work for, George Connell. And if you Google George Connell's name and Mike Wallace's name, you'll come up to a press conference or a round table that was held back in the 1980s, where they talked about, you know, journalism and such. And it was all about Vietnam, because Connell was a Vietnam War veteran and all this, but they were talking about the press. And they gave Peter Jennings this scenario that he was now embedded with basically the equivalent of the Viet Cong. And he was reporting from the Viet Cong. And he said he had no problem with that. He's a journalist. He can be with them. And he said, okay, now you're coming. And now an American patrol is coming. And the Viet Cong are positioning to do an ambush. What do you do? And he says, I filmed the ambush. And all the journalists are like, yes, of course, you're a journalist. You must film the ambush. A journalist must be neutral. A journalist must be this. And later on, they asked Connell about that. And he said, well, here's the deal. 2 days later, Jennings is coming in, and the post is attacked, and he's out there in the middle of it. And, you know, we're going to be asked to go out and risk our lives to rescue him. He said, but he's a journalist. Why would we rescue him? He's just a journalist. He's nothing. He said, of course, we're going to go, we're going to do it, we're going to die. But I mean, that, you know, the counter point is that American military has far more honor than these journalists. But the real point is, back then it was okay. I mean, mainstream journalists were talking about embedding themselves with forces who were going to film the ambush of American soldiers, and NPR and everybody went, that's journalism, objective neutrality, baby. Film the Americans getting killed. That's okay. Eva Bartlett goes to Syria and Ukraine to film the truth about what's happening to the people of Syria, the people of Aleppo, and the people of the Donbass, and you're an enemy combatant? My God, what has happened to our nations, our respective nations? I'm sickened by it, sickened by it.
You know, and the thing is, like, I have gone to frontline positions, but not that many times. You know, that's like Patrick Lancaster. He's the guy that's always on the front line filming military, and of course a Donbass Russian journalist. I've done it once in the Donbass. I'm trying to remember Syria. Most of my work is just civilians. It's just literally going to areas where civilians are being hammered by terrorist mortars, terrorist shells, Ukrainian forces shells, and reporting on what happens to them. That's it. Like, that's not even embedding, you know, with certain forces. It's literally like paying the taxi and going to these areas at my own risk. I'm not tooting anything, but I'm just saying, like, this is how it works. Like, a bombing happens in Kharkiv, Western Donetsk. I hail a taxi with another journalist. Maybe we go there under the risk that another bombing could happen, and we record what we can. We interview what we can. That's like what you're, Scott, what you're describing, it's like that was accepted back then, but going to talk to civilians is not.
Well, what about this too, Eva? The Syrian Medical Association, SMA or SAM. Something like that. Yeah, SAM, S-A-M. They raise money in the United States and Canada, and they send doctors over who embed with Al-Qaeda, literally Al-Qaeda, and they provide medical support, including hospitals that treat Al-Qaeda fighters straight from the front line. Now, by law, U.S. code, they are enemy combatants. And yet they're allowed to raise funds here and operate. CNN has a award-winning journalist whose name I can't remember right now. But she hires She hires Al-Qaeda fixers to take her into Al-Qaeda territory where she interviews Al-Qaeda fighters. And she does the most gross propaganda trying to mainstream this hateful ideology. But she's given an award for it. Vanessa goes and reports just on the truth. She's not trying to whitewash anything. She's just saying, this is what I'm seeing. This is the fact. And you're an enemy combatant. The world is literally flipped upside down.
What was the name of that? What was the name of that CNN reporter?
Clarissa Ward, famously known as the backpack sniffer, because she deciphered that the Syrian army had used a chemical weapon by sniffing someone's backpack.
Okay.
All right. Let's go to the questions from our audience. Eve, as you might know, we call this Ask the Inspector because our audience asked the inspector questions, and we let them know in advance that you would be here. So some of the questions are aimed specifically at you. Others, we can just feel our way through it. Maybe both of you can answer. And I'll leave it up to both of you how extensively you want to answer. Just know that we have a lot more questions, both that were submitted in advance and from our live audience, than we'll be able to get to. So you might want to keep that in mind and answer accordingly as you wish. So Svetlana, how do you say that?
Svetlana.
Svetlana, somewhere from the, on the planet Earth, how do you protect your analysis from other creeping motives that may be getting involved? How do you make sure your view is balanced and not buoyed by one side that loves you because you say what they want to hear?
I think we've already touched on that. At least I have. I go to the place in question. I report, you know, what I see. So,
all right, we can.
I'll just answer that partly here. You know, Jeff, this is a conversation you and I have repeated, and I don't know what Eva's business model is. Eva has to live, she has to eat, she has to take care of her dog. So I imagine there has to be an income stream. But you know, Jeff and I have struggled with this because, you know, do you do things to that generate income, or do you put things out there with no paywall? And it says, because you love, you say what they want to hear. It's, you know, if you're attached, and this is the danger with corporate media, mainstream media, is they're addicted to their paycheck. So they have to please their masters. And Jeff and I have tried to make sure that we are master free, meaning that if somebody wants to support us, it's voluntary in nature and it's not linked to specific artists. But the danger there is if I write something, and it generates a lot of money, I might be tempted to repeat that formula to raise, you know, to generate income. So it's not just about the praise and all that. It's about money. Money corrupts everything, but you can't live without money. So it's a finding that nice balance right there is a very difficult thing, I think, to retain. But, you know, oh, Jeff's giving me the sign that it was a 3-minute lightning.
Okay, but can I just bounce off that then quickly?
In terms of
saying paywalls, I'm glad you mentioned that because I can't put anything. The only thing I've ever put behind a paywall on my Patreon is like a thank you, a personal thank you message to my supporters. And at some point I made maybe once or twice and made clear to them, the people that support me on Patreon, look, I can't in good conscience, I can't put anything, you know, interviews I've done from anywhere. I can't put it behind a paywall because I don't believe in doing that. If I write a poem, I'll put that behind a paywall. But, and people have said like, no, that's fine. We just want to support you. So
Similar. The supporters are doing it out of benevolence, not to get access to the content. They get access anyway.
Yeah, it's free. Like, they'll find the same content on my blog or on social media. So
why would you charge people to hear you say thank you? I don't understand.
No, it's not that I'm charging them. It's just that I'm giving them a personal thank you that doesn't go out to the public, basically. Uh-huh. It's like, uh-huh. It's me saying, like, look, I'm sorry, I'm not giving you personalized content. Here's my thank you. I do appreciate your support, but I can't put this behind a paywall. Even if I shared it on Patreon and I didn't share it anywhere else, I still couldn't put it on behind a paywall, because I just feel like it feels like I'm exploiting the people I've interviewed. That's why I say, if I wrote some bad poetry, or drew some bad painting or something, and put that behind a paywall and people want to see it, okay, that's fine. But so in that regard, like, if I repeat myself, it's because I believe in the issue. But then in terms of media, like how media works, I could write every single day about Gaza or Syria, but that's not how media works. You can't write about something unless it's in the news. So you have to, I'm just speaking about like pitching articles, for example, and I actually should make this point too. And Scott, I'm sure you have this experience as well. Like, when you write an op-ed for RT or somewhere, it's not guaranteed they're going to take it. You pitch it and they decide whether or not it's of interest to them. It's not like they're saying, hey, this is what you're going to write. It's like you're saying to them, I want to write this. I feel it's timely. Let's see if we can do this. And they'll either say yes or no. So I think that's something my detractors do not realize, because they make all these comments about, you know, Kremlin propagandists. And it's just like, no, this has always been my words. It just happens to be that I have a platform on RT, but I'm the one pitching to them.
Yeah. You're writing on spec. Basically you're writing the article and then I've done that before. I'll write something and send it and say, hey, this happened. This is what I want. And then it's up to them to decide whether or not they want it. Other times we'll discuss something. I'll write it and they'll come back and say, very rarely do they say no. Maybe that's because they sit on it. They sit on it until it doesn't become timely anymore. And then it just dies a slow death. So yeah, there's no guarantee of publication. And the thing is, if they don't publish it, you don't get paid. So let me just finish with this, Jeff. Everybody watching this, support Eva Bartlett. Go to her website, support Eva Bartlett. She deserves the support. She is literally the lifeblood of what we want journalism to be. So
your website, Eva?
Yeah, how do they support you?
There's a donate button on the right, if you're on a computer, on the right side of my blog, ingaza.wordpress.com, I believe it is.
That's an awfully long URL. I have to talk to you about being concise and making it easy for the public to get.
Yeah, you know what? Okay.
Double your income if you do.
When we were talking earlier about like how I produce things, how I do, and I've been saying this for a long time, so people say I'm like a broken record, but I do need to make a proper website just with my name and like merge all my stuff past and current. It's just very daunting to me, because every time I think about it, I'm just like, oh, there's too many choices. I can't do it.
We might be able to help you out, Eva. Yeah.
we definitely can help. And I'll tell you one thing you can do immediately. You can just like use one of those link pages and just get a simple URL for that page. That's all you have to do. Whatever, evabartlett.com or whatever, something like that. And just give that out. And then when they get to your page with all the links, and they can get to your various pages.
Okay. Anyway, I do have a link tree. I don't know if that's what you meant.
Yeah. Yeah, right. But I mean, what I'm saying is you could attach a simple URL to the link tree instead of having link tree dot blah, 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 blah. You could whatever, you know, something that's simple and easy like evabartlett.com. All right. So by the way, I just want to add real quick that it sounds like Eva's funding policy is very similar to ours, Scott, in that she's relying on the benevolence of her audience. And I would just like to say that means the people who are donating are not only donating to us, but in a sense, they're donating to people who are less, who have less money than they have. In other words, they're enabling the members of the public who aren't able to pay to see what they otherwise would not see. So you're doing a good thing on more than one level, and I just want to salute everybody and thank you for your support. Here's a question specifically for Eva from Anwar in Zone B. Have you seen any friendly fire civilian casualties in Donbass?
I'm trying to understand that question. If they mean, have I seen any any civilians that have been killed by Russian fire. No, I haven't. I know people say, like, how do you know it's Ukrainian firing? And I hope Scott can touch on this, but the people living under fire know from where it's coming. They know. They know that by the point of impact of whatever the artillery is. And then you have the experts like the JCCC, and I forget what the acronym stands for, but they're military experts, that every time there's, for example, just let's take Donetsk alone, but like even like the entire DPR and Donbass, but just in Donetsk alone, whenever there's an attack, you have the military experts go there and collect what fragments they can of whatever whatever's left of the shell, examine the point of impact, measure it, measure if there's like an actual crater, they measure that, how deep it is, how wide is it, et cetera. They can gather from the point of impact from what direction the shell has come, and from all that information, they can determine the size of the shell, the distance it can fly, et cetera, et cetera. And so I actually, back in August, the Donbass Palace Hotel, which is one of the few hotels, like one of the big hotels journalists stay in, was bombed. It wasn't itself like directly bombed. It was bombed right outside the hotel. And I was staying in the hotel at that time. Normally I rent an apartment, and ever since I've gone back to renting an apartment, but that particular time I was staying in the hotel. And so when the bombings occurred, I was inside and obviously understood that it was a lot closer than just other bombings. And actually when the fifth shell hit that landed right outside the hotel and killed a woman that was outside on the sidewalk, I had literally just stepped out of the lobby. So thankfully I wasn't injured. But what was my point with that? That was a NATO shell. And oh yeah, my point was that later on Twitter, trolls actually took the map of Donetsk, turned it 90 degrees and said, oh, well, it came, clearly like it hit the entrance, it hit the eastern side, therefore it, like it came from the east because it hit the entrance, because they inverted the map by 90 degrees. But in fact, the direction the shells came from was from the north, from Ukrainian forces. So just back to the point of like, every time I've gone to a place where there have been casualties, I'm not a military expert, but those who are have determined that the shells have been fired from positions that are occupied by Ukrainian forces. So I don't believe that I've ever seen casualties that have been as a result of Russian shelling.
One of the interesting things, just to add on that, Jeff, if what you say, can I ping off of that? Can I bounce off of that? Yeah. The IAEA is under a lot of fire from the Russian side because they claim they can't determine where the shelling of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is coming from. And I facetiously, Jeff, help me out. Eva, this is the danger of being on a program with a Marine, because my grasp of the English language is non-existent. Facetiously said that the Russians were shelling themselves, basically. And I posted a page out of a Marine Corps crater analysis training manual. Crater analysis is just what Eva was talking about. When a shell hits, it creates a crater. And at the bottom of the crater, because there's usually a fuse, the fuse will blow a separate hole in it that if you put a stick, and that literally what we did, we had a stick. We put it in there, line it up with the fuse hole, and the stick points to exactly where the shell came from. You can also do the splatter analysis and all that. You can get all that. But, you know, I trained every Marine, and I'm talking about training some pretty dense people here. And they could do this job because we needed that as target intelligence. When you were getting shelled, if we're going to put out effective counter battery fire, this is back in the day before counter battery radars became prominent on the battlefield, Marines would have to run out and quick do a crater analysis. They do a shell fragment analysis, and then they'd write a report that would come back and would tell me, you know, the azimuth of the shell, the fragments. And then I'd plot it on a map, and where they triangulate, you know, trisection, not triangulate, but trisection, that's where it came from. And if I could get that target quick enough, I could put shells on that and kill the enemy before they got us. That's the idea. But my point is, if I can train a Marine Corps Lance Corporal to do this, the IAEA literally has nuclear scientists, the smartest people in the world, and they can't tell me where the... I could look at a photograph and tell you where it came from. So that's ludicrous. The other thing I'll just say about the Russians, you know, shelling Donetsk. understand this. Any professional artillery officer knows that you don't put a civilian, you don't put a residential area between you and your target, because habitually there are short rounds. The powder, the charges that you put in don't operate. The round goes short. Happens all the time. So you never, for instance, in this case, put your artillery behind Donetsk to fire over Donetsk to get to the Ukrainians. That is just isn't done. And it, but that would be what it would have to happen for there to be Russian rounds landing in Donetsk. And they just don't do that. And you know this because there's satellite photographs. The Russians don't like you looking at them, but you can plot out where their artillery's positioned, and it's never behind Donetsk. It's always to the left, to the right. They don't fire over civilian occupied areas, especially urban areas like Donetsk. So anybody who says that the Russians are selling themselves, they're trolls. They're basically, you know, anti-Russian, pro-Ukrainian trolls who are spreading propaganda and disinformation.
Are we in an air raid?
Bob from Berlin, Germany. It's going to be incredibly difficult to win people's hearts and minds over should Russia prevail. Why do you think the Russians are not engaging in the information war right now within Ukraine, especially?
Eva.
It's a hard question. I've thought about that. I think they are to some degree engaging in the information war, but I think for them, facts on the ground or the actual war is more important. I think also, I don't know, my take is like the way the West engages in the information war is so dirty that Russia won't stoop to that level. I mean, the things the West does, they literally take buildings that have been shelled by Ukraine and then transpose them to somewhere in Ukraine and claim this is a building shelled by Russia, you know, and they did similar things or the same things in Syria. They literally fabricated incidents that never occurred. They took photographs from, I'm talking now about Syria. They took photographs, like, for example, from Iraq and claimed it was somewhere in Syria. That was the BBC, by the way. I know it's kind of like, it's quite ironic because the way the West depicts Russian media is, you know, Russian media is the worst thing in the world. But from what I've seen, Russian media has attempted to be more fair and giving voice to like many sides than Western media has. And I haven't seen the dirty tricks of Western media in Russian media. I haven't seen all these fabrications that we see coming out endlessly from Ukrainian and Western media. So if that means Russia is losing the information war, I don't know, maybe it's up to us to pick up the slack, but let me rephrase that. My intention is not to pick up the slack for Russia. My intention is always ever to report what I'm seeing in the place in question. But in terms of fighting the propaganda, Russia actually isn't doing terribly at that, because there are some Telegram channels that as soon as there's a fake Ukrainian fake or a Western fake, then there's a counterpoint to that. There's a few channels actually doing that. But I guess my point is that I haven't seen Russian media stoop to the degenerate levels of Western media.
I'll just quick bounce off Eva. I like that term. The battlefield, I mean, you're talking about information war, you know, Russia, it'd be a waste of time for Russia to engage in an information war in the West or in Ukraine, because it's an unequal playing field. Russia will never be given a fair hearing, et cetera. So Russia, you know, we sit here in the West going, Russia's got to do a better job of what? Convincing us? that's a fight Russia really doesn't care about. With Ukraine, you know, the Ukrainians Russia cares about are the former Ukrainian citizens of what is now Southern Russia, Novaya Russa, whatever you want to call it. You know, ask them. They're the ones that need to be talked to. The ones who get the humanitarian aid, the one who get the medical treatment, the ones who get the services provided, you know, get the gas lines brought in, get the electricity brought in, making sure there's food, making sure there's sanitation. Russia has stepped up. They're not perfect. I'm not going to sit here and pretend that Russia's perfect. No one is. But Russia has stepped up to help the people of Donbas, of Kherson, of Zaporizhia. live a normal life. And that's the only hearts and souls they want to win right now. They can't fight in Kiev and win over the population of Kiev. And the other battlefield that's a very important one that we miss in the West is the battlefield at home in Russia. You know, there is a concerted effort by the CIA, by MI6, by the Ukrainian government to create this impression that the Russian people are dissatisfied with the Russian government, and they're trying to create the conditions for what they call a Moscow Maidan. They want to, you know, create this revolution in Moscow that ousts Vladimir Putin. And so they're flooding the zone, so to speak, with disinformation. And, the Russians would be fools not to treat this seriously. It doesn't mean that Vladimir Putin is vulnerable or anything, but it means that they have to respond. So I think there is a lot of effort at home to stabilize the home front from an information standpoint. This is why Vladimir Putin does things like meet with the mothers of fallen soldiers. That was a carefully canned event. I'm not saying it was disingenuous, but it was a planned event to achieve a specific outcome, not to impress us here in the West, but to reach out to a Russian domestic audience. And so if you take a look at Vladimir Putin's popularity and you look at the political stability that's in Russia, they're winning the information war at home. They're winning it, despite everything that's being done. And people say, well, it's a controlled media. Have you been on Telegram lately? There ain't nothing controlled about Telegram. Have you been on any of the social media outlets? There's nothing controlled about that. It is the wild, wild west of information, disinformation out there, and every Russian has access to it. So the Russian government has to respond to what's going on there to make sure that the Russian population doesn't get, you know, wooed over by misinformation.
Speaking of information warfare, Scott, of course, is our primary writer at Scott Ritter Extra. That's kind of why we call it Scott Ritter Extra. But we also have an information warfare specialist, Kevin Michelizzi, and this is his new article about troll farms, modern information warfare. And Tori and I will be interviewing him later today on our other podcast, Scenes from the Evolution. So hopefully you kind people will tune in and check that out. Moving on to somebody from the UK, for Eva Bartlett. Again, many in the West do not accept that the West has close ties to terrorists like ISIS. Can you give any examples of people or events which corroborate such assertions? For example, who controlled Jihadi John, who beheaded people on video?
Oh, I can't speak to who controlled Jihadi John. What I can say about those ISIS videos is they were very slick production. So already you should be a little bit skeptical of how. I'm sorry, I can't see any of you. Am I still on? Okay.
You're on.
I mean, those ISIS videos, the ones that had like the multiple camera angles and the slick production, were highly suspect. I mean, in my mind, they were, I'm not saying that the people in the videos weren't decapitated or grossly murdered, but just the slick production value made me extremely suspicious, just like, you know, the White Helmets videos. But as for who controlled Jihadi John, no, but I mean, well, let's see. You had the Qatari former foreign minister. What was his name? Some years ago, when there was a falling out between Qatar and Saudi Arabia, he basically came out and said, "I know this is Qatar, not the West," but he basically came out and said, "Yes, we were funding Nusra, we were funding Al Qaeda." You have various over the years. You have various revelations that the West was funding Al Qaeda in Syria. So, you know, whereas I can't speak to that one particular example, it's well known that for decades the West wanted to overthrow the Syrian government by any means possible. And what's happened in the last decade since 2011 is the latest incarnation of their attempts to oust the Syrian government and install a puppet government. If I understand why people in the West wouldn't understand, wouldn't believe that our governments are supporting ISIS or Nazis in Ukraine, but there is enough documentation out there. You just have to be willing to look for it, and you have to be willing to actually, like, what's the term? There's a term for it's a bit late, so I'm losing this term, but the term for when you It'll come to me when you have information present, but you just can't believe it because it just doesn't fit with your narrative. And I think that's what people face when they're
cognitive dissonance. Is that what you're thinking?
Thank you. That's what it was. I knew it was a two-word term. Thank you.
Dictionary.
Do I win a prize?
Yeah. You get a smile from one of my dogs, but they're asleep. Yeah. I mean, I know that term. It's just, yeah, it slipped my mind. Yeah. So I think that people think like, oh, it's just too big a thing. It's too impossible, you know, our government to be funding and supporting and whitewashing the crimes of Al Qaeda or Nazis in Ukraine. But it's not too big. It's actually a thing. It's reality. It's just, you have to come to terms with it. I mean, even the New York Times will admit things like this when they're trying to save face, I suppose.
One of the great ironies, you know, there's that concept of blowback, you know, where you do something and then it comes back. And Syria is a prime example of this. We in the United States, we created something called, yes, Mr. Mihailovich, I'm responding to things. I'm going to see you in Ann Arbor. I'm actually looking forward to that trip, but there it is. But the State Department funded something called digital democracy back in the late Bush era. And they had this Jared Cohen, I think his name is, ran this part. And the idea was to use social media platforms as a mechanism of winning over the youth, and then using them to mobilize the youth, et cetera. And so you had Twitter, you had Facebook, you had other things, but it wasn't just that. The State Department would then hold these training seminars where people come in and get trained on how to use your cell phone or digital camera to film things, events. So like if you went to a demonstration, what to film, how to film it, what angles, production values, and then to upload it rapidly onto social media. And then the mainstream media was put on notice that these channels or these links are going to have product that they would take and immediately run. So all the stuff you saw on the evening news came from this effort. And in Syria, they had these local community activists. There's a specific term. Early on, they're the ones who went out and filmed the demonstrations and things of this nature, and captured it and sent it up. And it was all used as propaganda against the Syrian government, even though it was distorted. They were specifically told how to take angles, how to, you know, post one thing but have it say another. But my point is, many of these people went on to become ISIS and Al Qaeda video producers. Yeah. Here's where the iron, this is where, again, I don't mean to smile because people are dying, but they did such a good job of propagandizing on behalf of Al Qaeda and ISIS that the State Department had to create a special unit, a counter disinformation unit, to take on ISIS. So the State Department had to go to war against the people that the State Department originally trained to carry out this slick production. That's the insanity of the United States approach on just about everything.
You know, Scott, now I've been actually for years trying to remember who told me this story, but what you were just saying about youths being trained on filming and hashtagging and Twitter techniques. I had somebody back in 2015 in Syria tell me this, and he told me, I just wish I could remember who, but I've racked my brain and I can't figure out who it was, but it was somebody I had a real life conversation with. He said, like, he used to play online poker or something, and he was selected for this, one of these training things in the south of Syria, in Dara region, or in Sweda, I think it was. And it was like a week or something. And they were, just as you were saying, they're trained in these techniques. Back in 2011, or actually this might've been in 2010 before things started in Syria. So back then, none of us knew any of these techniques for like social media tactics, right? At least I certainly didn't. And so these people were trained in it. And he said, like, one of the people he knew from the training went on to become a member of the FSA, the Free Syrian Army. And then, you know, they would have progressed on towards becoming Nusra or ISIS. So there's that. And there's also, I remember I interviewed a doctor who was in Dara, southern Syria, in March, April 2011, when things were kicking off. He was at a military hospital. He was a skin doctor, so he wasn't needed, but he was at the hospital. And he said, like, the day he was there, there was enough staff present that he was just sitting in some lounge room drinking coffee, watching TV, and Al Jazeera was on. And it showed they were broadcasting from his hospital. Now, this is not even in Dara City, but in some Dara town. Whenever I would go in rural areas of Syria with my Samsung, I would lose reception. I couldn't upload a video, a photo, you know, anything. This, and I'm talking like from 2014 on when I started going to Syria, this is in 2011. And there's some woman in one of the hospital rooms uploading video, live video footage. And she was saying like, oh, there's not enough doctors, when in fact there were so many doctors. This friend was sitting there drinking coffee. He also told me that all the doctors had been instructed, it was a military hospital, but they've been instructed by the head of the hospital to treat civilians first if they came to the hospital. And so this woman streaming from this hospital was saying there's not enough doctors, they're not treating civilians. And obviously that wasn't true. So this kind of ties into what you're saying, like these people being trained with these tactics. And then what kind of, did she have a satellite phone? What kind of phone did she have?
She had a CIA provided satellite phone. Now, it wasn't given to her by the CIA. It was given to her by a non-governmental organization. But I don't want to get too far afield, but they all, even the people that later went on to work for Al-Qaeda and ISIS, they retained connectivity with the people who trained them, thinking that the people who trained them were just, you know, an innocent American civilian. And so they're communicating with somebody who's actually a CIA case officer who's controlling an ISIS propagandist. It's just crazy how the United States operated there. I mean, but they all had these, I forget the brand name, began with a TH, Thuringia or something like that, but it's a brand of a satellite telephone that's why they had good connectivity throughout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just want to mention that article one more time. Kevin Michalizzi knows all about this stuff. He was blown my mind when we were talking yesterday about the extent to which the U.S. military is involved in training people to do all these cyber hijinks. So we'll be talking about that at 4:30 today, Pacific time, 7:30 Eastern. Ultimata from Western Australia. What are your thoughts on the protests in China? Is this another crazy regime change attempt in the face of the collapse of U.S. hegemony?
I'll just go real quick on it. I think it's a legitimate social response to very stringent COVID. It's an all too human response of people who've been locked up, et cetera. I don't think the CIA has the connectivity, the bandwidth in the Chinese population to do something like this. I think this is a legitimate internal problem that the Chinese are struggling to deal with.
Okay. Let's go on to the next question. H. Sheridan from Washington, D.C. for Eva Bartlett. What differences have you observed from the beginning of the Donbas conflict, which was mostly ignored by the media, and now that Russia's special military operation has begun? What, if any, changes or impacts have you had to go through during this conflict?
What differences? Gosh, that's a hard question. I guess the difference is that, the main difference is that as of February 2022, Western corporate media or legacy media erased any mention of Nazis in Ukraine, whereas in prior years you could find even Canadian media, which is Canada has been a big sponsor of the Nazi battalions in Ukraine. You could find in Canadian media criticism of the fact that Canadian army and government were supporting Nazis. So I guess that's one major thing, is like this complete attempt to erase any sort of reporting on Nazis in Ukraine, because by erasing them, then the Western media is then propping up this narrative that, you know, poor Ukraine is just this innocent victim and Russia is just this belligerent aggressor, blah, blah, blah. Along with erasing any sort of mention of Nazis in Ukraine, you have the erasure of Ukraine's 8 years of warring on the Donbas. Now, I think the United Nations has said 14,000 people were killed in the 8 years of war. I know when I wrote an article, referring back to my March visit to the Donbass and the French media that totally distorted what we were all told and what we all saw. Back then, I researched using Donbass sources, so the DPR ombudsperson and ombudswoman and the, I can't remember the official source in the Lugansk, but back then, the number of civilians alone killed in the Donbass was 8,000. That was back in like end of March this year. Since then, the number is much greater, and that's killed by Ukrainian shelling and sniping. So you have none of that reported in Western corporate media. So sorry, if you can go back to the question, I'm just trying to remember what else they were asking there. I mean, in terms of like any sort of compassion for the people of Donbass, that's remained consistently absent in Western corporate media. No compassion whatsoever. The people of the Donbass have been written off as Russian-backed separatists, not as people that just didn't want the massacres that were happening in 2014 to come to them, people that didn't want to be persecuted for speaking their own language and remembering and revering their history. So that hasn't changed. On the other hand, Ukraine, well, actually, I'm sure you're all familiar with this article that was republished in the Post still. It was written by Jacques Baude, and he was speaking about the events leading up to, and I know, Scott, you've spoken about this as well, the events leading up to the commencement of Russia's special military operation and the fact that Ukraine was increasing its shelling of the Donbass republics very much dramatically increasing the shelling of the Donbass republics. And that wasn't reported in Western corporate media. But I guess now, speaking from my own experience in the months subsequent, like April, May, June, July, I've been there pretty much every month since I went back there in March, spending a few weeks each time and then coming back here and then going back there for another few weeks. Each time I've gone there, Ukraine has shelled the very center of Donetsk. The very center, we're talking like totally civilian streets, residential areas, parks, playgrounds, hospitals, marketplaces, using weaponry coming from the West. So I suppose that's, I mean, I know they were shelling civilian areas. Ukraine was shelling civilian areas heavily during the course of the 8 years of war. But the intensified shelling of the center of Donetsk, to me, that's something that's new in terms of this question.
All right. I just want to say something about the value of Eva's reporting. You know, I've been speaking out on these issues, and I've been doing some public speaking. And at every venue I go to, there are people from Lugansk and Donetsk who show up. And they are literally people who have, for the past 8 years, been non-people because there's no reporting it. And you know, the anguish that they feel as human beings to be of this land that they love, but to have the world ignore them, to pretend they don't exist, that the suffering their fellow citizens are going through, the suffering they're going through long distance. I mean, just imagine being far away. You know, any American who had a family in Florida when the hurricane hit and was wondering what happened to their family. Hey, guys, that terror you felt for a day or two when you couldn't call them. These people feel for 8 years, years. And your reporting is invaluable to them because you make them feel like they exist. You give their life purpose and meaning and all that. And I mean, it's been really rewarding for me to have people come up afterwards and say, hey, I'm from Lugansk, or I'm from Donetsk, and, you know, what you've done has meant a lot to me. It's helped me sleep at night. I mean, the idea that Scott Ritter some help people sleep at night is a first. But Eva Bartlett, let me tell you, you help people sleep at night because your reporting gives their life meaning. It makes them feel like they exist. They're part of the world. They're no longer invisible. So on behalf of all the people who came to me, I thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Scott. And, you know, it's the same. Vanessa and I and others who've reported from Syria have heard the same thing. You know, Assyrians have, I mean, it hasn't happened like that often, but I have had Syrians approach me in airplanes and in the Beirut airport, in an airport in Germany, and just say, like, you know, we've been trying to say this and nobody would believe us. We've been trying to say, you know, what's happening in our country. In December 2016, after I left Syria and went to New York to give a lecture, and then I was giving some lectures around the States, I had a Syrian doctor based in New York break down in tears. And again, the same thing. He was just saying, like, I've been trying to tell people this, but nobody would listen to me. And, you know, just back to this whole Western media and in impartiality and neutrality or all that crap, it's just like, but you... How can you even discuss Western media being neutral or impartial when they actively disappear people whose voices don't fit their narrative, you know? And it's just like, you have a chance to meet with some of these people, and they're human beings that, like Scott has just outlined, are suffering immensely. And if they got the Western media treatment of actually being highlighted, then their stories, their faces would be on the media 24/7. I'm sorry. Did I mention the 14-year-old kid that I met in Donetsk who lost his foot to a pedal mine? I'm a bit tired. Did I already speak about that tonight?
You did.
I did. Yeah. So I mean,
speak about it again. You could speak about it.
Well, I'll just in speaking about that. Sorry for repeating that, but like that issue alone, if that were that's where Western media would capitalize on this and they would highlight it, and I wish we could highlight it more. I'm doing what I can to do so, but like as of a couple of days ago, 87 civilians have lost a hand or a foot to these mines. I remember reading about a case of an older woman with dementia who could be my mom. My mom has dementia. She wandered out in, to go to her garden and stepped on a mine and lost her foot, you know? And that's the thing, like, obviously anybody's at risk. Even an emergency services sapper lost a foot after they cleared an area and then a mine blew off a rooftop. And like, obviously they didn't expect where they were walking to be dangerous. So this issue, the mines that Ukraine fired largely at the end of July are still plaguing Donbass civilians, you know, and just like between the terror, the other thing is the psychological terror. When I was in Donetsk in September during the referendum, I was there before, during, and after the referendum. And at one point I was going with a taxi driver from Donetsk to, where did I go to? Kirovsky, Western Donetsk, a very hard hit district, a district shelled by Ukrainian forces a lot. And the driver was saying, like, during the battles in Mariupol, he had spent a lot of time there, I assume, driving journalists around. And he said he felt more at danger in Donetsk now than he did then, which is something considering how much, you know, media played up like the battles in Mariupol. Yeah, I was in Mariupol when in April, so there was still fighting going on. You could still hear the shelling of Azovstal and areas around there. But like this guy was saying, the difference was in Donetsk, you never know when or where the Ukrainian shells are going to strike. So there's that psychological terror as well between the pedal mines, the fact that Ukraine is shelling anywhere and it's off limits, or nothing's off limits, rather. No one's going to hold them accountable. Nobody's going to ever report honestly, you know, at least in terms of legacy media or supposedly neutral bodies like the UN or OSCE or whatever.
All right. Well, it's very late at night for Eva, and you mentioned that you're tired. So I just want to ask, we can make that the last of the pre-submitted questions, but we do have a bunch of people watching live who have asked some questions. Do you have it in you to stick around for a few more minutes to handle some of the live questions? Okay, Scott, I see you. Calm yourself. The weapons inspector goes crazy if he doesn't speak. Go ahead, darling.
No, I don't want to speak. I want to ask a question. It was a question I didn't get to ask Eva when she was on the competing podcast, Jeff.
it's so competitive.
You speak about the human cost, and of course that is the utmost value, but you're a dog owner. I'm a dog owner. I saw a video where you visited a animal shelter where they take care of the man's best friend. That gets caught up in this war. Could you tell people about that and what that experience was like?
Yeah, so there, I've actually gone to two different dog shelters or animal shelters. The first was in the west of Donetsk, and it had like 400 dogs and a few like chickens and what else did they have? A couple of random animals. But then this other one I went to twice recently in the southeast of Donetsk has 800 dogs. And these would have been a combination of street dogs, because there are a lot of street dogs in Donetsk and Russia as well. Dogs that had been abandoned or lost, you know, over the course of the months of fighting. Dogs, unfortunately, that maybe were abused, but I don't know how common that is, but it does happen like anywhere. And the shelter is, like from what I could see, they're providing very good. They had like a on-site veterinarian and veterinary setup. And they seem to be providing excellent care for the animals. They exist on donations. I said they're in the east of Donetsk. They're still shelled, maybe not as heavily as of Kiev's, as Kievsky or Kirovsky, but they're still shelled. And since you know dogs, like they're extremely sensitive to sound, right? Like one of my dogs, if there's a thunderstorm, she runs to the bathroom and quivers in fear. So I can't imagine, I don't even want to think about really how the dogs feel under the bombing, the incessant bombing. Like, unfortunately, they've gotten used to it. You will see dogs just lying around in the streets, like street dogs lying around on the side of the sidewalk or whatever, just accustomed to it. But it shouldn't be that way. They have to be, if that sound is terrifying to us humans, for them it's magnified. So I do have footage from that shelter. I haven't had time to edit it. I will put it on my channel, but if you guys want to link to their Telegram channel, they do how to donate to them if you're in the West. I guess I'm not sure if it would be like crypto or whatever, but they do need and accept donations, and I think that they're doing great work. Actually, my last visit there, Scott, I met what I hope will be my third dog. He was just such a beautiful guy. It just, I was waiting to speak with the woman that runs the place, and this white dog came up to me, and he and I bonded right away. And I would have brought him back. It's just that I'm renting the current place where I'm staying, and I didn't know that the landlords would accept a third dog, but he was such a beautiful, gentle soul. So if I can twist their arm, then I'll go back and get them.
This wasn't the tripod. You had the three-legged dog there that you were filmed with, that you seem to be bonding with as well. Is this different?
This one was, he had an injured leg. So I think it was the same one you're thinking of, like okay. A beautiful white dog that kind of popped. Yeah.
That was his actual name, Tripod, or that's?
No, that's just me naming a dog.
Well, they called him Ice. But somebody else, I shared his photo on social media, and somebody else said, you should call him Donetsk. And I thought, that's kind of maybe appropriate.
All right. So should we take some questions live from the audience? And while Tori's lining that up, we can check in real quick with our man at the front lines, Malcolm Nance.
Three cruise missile caliber.
Oh, but Scott, please. Did you see that photo where Malcolm's dressed up? And I, again, not being a military expert, I don't know, but people on social media were saying like he's got it all rigged up wrong.
Yeah, no, is well, see, I'm old school, so I never had any of this fancy gear that they have today. But I took a photo of how he had it set up, and then I got a photo of a Delta Force guy's rig, and you're just going, nah, man.
There's nothing authentic about that guy. That's why he's our mascot.
That's why.
He's a great mascot. All right. Hey, live questions from the audience. When will China come to bail Russia out?
They already are. The China's buying oil. China's saying that they are economically linked with Russia, that they're going to move forward on all these development programs. If it weren't for China being willing to buy Russian oil, and they're buying a lot of Russian oil and Russian gas, the Russian economy would have a problem. So, you know, but it's not a bailout. China understands that they're before the grace of God go us, meaning in terms of Western sanctioning, Western targeting. So China's working with Russia. People need to read the 5,000-word statement that was signed on February 4th of this year between Putin and Xi Jinping. It was a declaration of their intent to create a trans-Eurasian economic union. In order for that trans-Eurasian economic union to be viable, there has to be significant trade. And a large part of that trade is in Russia's number one commodity, which is energy.
I see Eva's dog is yawning too. the dog's normal bedtime hour?
Yeah, we're usually up at like 5:36.
Thank you for disrupting your lifestyle for us. We appreciate it. How long does it take to pay off a home in Donbas?
I have no idea. I suppose that would depend if you're a person from the region or if you're not, if you're coming in with American dollars or whatever. So I don't know.
That's American real estate developer Christopher Dobby. Mark Wilson, what does Eva Bartlett think of Brendan O'Connell, an Australian, quote, conspiracy reporter? Is he legitimate?
I feel like I know the name, but I don't know much about him, so I can't really speak to that. I feel like there's a negative connotation that maybe he's been talking negatively about other journalists I know, but I don't really remember anything about him, so can't say much.
And now we have Scott cuddling his dog. We have Tori behind the scenes. I don't know. Are you cuddling your dog too, Tori?
No, she's not in the room with me. All right.
Then I'm not alone. Let's see. Next question from Eva. You want to read that name? I'm sure it's no problem for you.
I have to open my eyes. It's kind of stylized. It's Lubimir. I can't read it. It's too stylized. What's your impression? What's your impressions of Serbia and the people of Serbia? Well, I spent a few months there at the end of 2020. I liked it a lot. Serbia is a beautiful country. I found Serbs to be very nice people. I don't know enough about the history of Serbia, but I know that they've been like Syria, like Donbass, greatly mistreated is an understatement. They've been attacked and had their country destroyed by the West. I had good interactions with Serbs, and I debated living there, but I decided I wanted to live in Russia.
Okay. Jimmy. Perhaps his surname is Florida. Perhaps he is from Florida. Will there be a backlash from Ukrainians when they lose the war after all their boys and men died in battle?
There's never a backlash. History shows there's never a backlash. I mean, that's the sad reality that society accepts the human cost of war when it comes to soldiers. Soldiers die. Plus, understand that when Ukraine loses, and they're going to lose, they're going to be more concerned about surviving than they are about, you know, the repercussions. Just take a look at, you know, Germany after World War One. It wasn't about the casualties; it was about the stab in the back that led to, you know, the discontent. After the end of the Second World War, you didn't see Germans in the streets complain about the number of dead. They complained about social conditions, living conditions, etc. Societies have this horrific ability to absorb. The only society that I know that focuses on their losses with any sincerity is Russia, focusing on the losses of the Great Patriotic War and the 27 million. And it's not that there was a repercussion, but there's an acknowledgement as a nation that they paid a horrible price for that victory. But I don't see the Ukrainians. I don't see the anger that comes out from that. Once the war is done, the survivors will move on. Maybe Eva has a different perspective, but mine's based upon history.
Mm-hmm. I'll leave it with you, Scott.
Okay. Speaking of which, you know, you said that you were an activist, and then you segued into journalism, but you do seem to have, I'm not referring to this question in particular, you do seem to have a good grasp of history. Was that something that you've always studied, or have you studied it more since you segued into journalism?
This question is for Scott?
No, for you.
But let me ask.
Should I repeat it?
Well, I mean, I'm actually kind of the first person to say I don't have a good grasp of history. I'm a product of the Canadian education system. I'm lucky that I know anything.
You make certain references that wouldn't occur to me, so I
No, I have a lot of gaps to fill in mm-hmm. terms of, not just history knowledge, but knowledge in other realms. But Yeah, I certainly wouldn't put myself up there as being super informed on history.
This next question is for Scott. Do you think U.S. and NATO can handle Russia winning this war, even if it means them losing their superpower status? Do you think they'll intervene then because their hegemony is on the line?
I think the U.S. and NATO handled the Taliban victory quite well. meaning you got beat. That's it. Russia's going to win this war. NATO and the United States are very careful not to couch this as a NATO-Russian conflict. So there will be the ability to separate. And you're seeing that already, I believe. You're seeing the West start to separate themselves from the inevitable outcome of this conflict. Their superpower status has been, that's been slipping away for some time. Because Russia is not actively fighting NATO, they're fighting a NATO proxy, NATO will still exist. And so the West will still exist. Their problems won't come from a Russian victory, but from the consequences of their failed sanctioning of Russia. That's the number one problem facing Europe and the United States today, is the economic fallout from this conflict. And I don't believe they'll ever intervene, because a direct intervention in Ukraine would set up a direct NATO-Russian conflict that could very well go nuclear. And as insane as the people are in the West, nobody's that crazy yet.
All right. So I'll suggest right now three more questions. But if you, Eva, or you, Scott, want to suggest less than that or more than that, go right ahead. What do you think?
I'm actually going to duck out, guys. I'm getting pretty tired.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much for joining us. We'll put a link for your website under the YouTube video so people can find it that way.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank
you, Eva. Stay safe.
Thank you. Good night. Okay.
All right. Yeah, I could see that it was getting pretty late there.
Yeah.
And her gorgeous dog. So this Friday night, what's that?
Two dogs. She has two dogs. Two gorgeous dogs.
Oh, okay. This Friday night, we won't be able to do our podcast as per usual because Scott will be in Ann Arbor. Where the event will be taking place at more or less the same time.
Okay.
But check back with us. We are talking about possibly doing it sometime on Saturday. We haven't figured that out yet.
And the weekend edition.
Yeah, the weekend edition. If we can possibly get our schedules to coincide, we'll do that. And then later today, we have Kevin Michalitzi talking about information warfare. And I guess that's it for this edition of Ask the Inspector. Thanks a lot, Scott.
Well, thanks, Jeff. Thanks for doing this. And thank you, Eva Bartlett. And thank you to all those people who are going to go out and support Eva, because she not only needs it, she deserves it.
And speaking of going out and supporting, Scott is going to be in Ann Arbor, Michigan this weekend. In fact, we have a little bit more detail here. And if you go to scottritterextra.com, we link to the website of the organizers. And they say at least a couple of these will be streamed live. I think the first two. All right, folks. Thanks a lot. Thanks, Tori and Eric, for your help behind the scenes. See you all soon.